You are listening to 10 Wrestling's 2300 Wrestling Podcast with DB Richards and Sweet Tea Referee Dave Keener on Anchor FM, Spotify, and other leading platforms.
Hello, this is DB Richards from the 2300 Wrestling Podcast, and this season is dedicated to Bill Pollarino. Rest in peace, my friend.
Welcome, everybody, to the 2300 Wrestling Podcast. I am your host, DB Richards, alongside my sweet tea referee, Dave Keener.
Why did you get tea and I got soda? How does that work? I mean, I thought I was the TA.
Dude, do you think I have money for you?
No, just wondering.
Okay, put that soda down. Put it down. Your red Solo cup. Go ahead.
I'm lifting it up.
What are you doing? We're starting a show.
I know, but I'm sorry. Toby Keith's in the back of my head.
What? I can't believe you.
What? Red Solo cup?
Dude, you're upset about everything. You called me up to shovel your pavement, and I said no, and you were upset about it because I was like, I have to get out of my driveway, and the roads are horrible. And
then you said no. I had to get the kids out of the video game to help me out. But anyway, moving on. Who's the guest on our show?
I don't know. No, it's your turn.
I want you to do it today.
No, you do it. No. It's your thing because I did the start. No, we're not shooting for it.
Just announce them.
No, you announce them.
No.
No, you.
Rabbit season.
Oh, my gosh. What are you doing? Dude, you always announce the person.
But you can do it every now and then.
No, it's not my point. I'm the guy that starts off the show. And you do did you hear the announcement? It went like this. Welcome, everybody, to the 2300 Wrestling Podcast. I am your host, DB Richards, alongside my sweet tea referee, Dave Keener.
See, that's how it works. I do that. And you do the announcement. Who do we have on tonight?
Now I got the tea in front of me.
Well, I'm just reading my Bible until you guys get your act together here.
It is Sunday.
You're right. That was earlier today for me. But
it is the holy day.
It is a holy day, and I do have holes in my jeans, too, so that's good.
It's not where we want to know where the holes are.
Be nice.
Yeah, no comment.
Now, I don't know if I'm saying it right, and I might not be correct if I'm wrong, and I apologize.
It's not that hard. You just... The trick to it is just say it. There's no fancy, emphasis on anything. You just blurt it out exactly as it reads.
All right, Derek Benesh?
Almost, Benesh.
Benesh. I was close.
See, it's okay close. To try.
That was the most common pronunciation, though, going through school, I will say. Keep it simple, stupid, as it says, the whole kiss philosophy.
I mean, people get my last name wrong all the time, and it's like Kenner, Keener, Kanner, Kerner. Like, no, it's just Keener. Get it right.
Everybody gets my last name wrong, too. Richards. It's weird.
How do you get Richards wrong? You are a dick, nonetheless, so...
They do call me douchebag.
Yeah, that's why it's DB.
Yeah.
You're douchebag Richards.
Let's start off the show, you know what I mean? But I want to bring up a question.
Like Fozzie Bear said, moving right along.
We're moving right along, yes, we are. Got a question. Do you think wrestling fans are negative to the sport of wrestling right now?
I think it's certain. Go ahead and finish.
Yeah, go ahead.
My whole issue with fans lately is they throw the race card in there, okay? Two of your top champions are ethnicity.
There you go.
Damian Priest. He's Puerto Rican.
Mm-hmm.
Roman Reigns is Samoan.
Seth Rollins is Spanish. You know, so why do you... Big E Langston held the world title for, what, the past year before he lost in that four-way?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so why are we putting that race card in there when it doesn't belong in there? I think if fans are going to say that, then they should know what they were talking about. Go ahead, Derek.
Yeah, wrestling fans these days, obviously so much different. So, you know, certainly I grew up in, largely the majority of the 80s, and I actually didn't become a wrestling fan until 1990. My main organization was the WWF at the time. It was really lured me in as a fan and really stayed with the organization until just about 2008. It was just becoming a chore to watch Raw, continue. And thank goodness for AEW because I took a sabbatical, very long sabbatical from 2008 all the way till the end of 2019.
Wow.
And then when AEW, so that's why I'll have a lot of guys, come up to me and talk about things that happened in the past like 5-10 years or so. And unfortunately, it's way too many years had passed by for me to kind of go backwards. But, you know, I did see the direction, though, at the time. Obviously, you know, I lived through really a phenomenal period of time. I lived through, you know, the Hogan era. I lived through the Attitude era, you know. And, you know, when I say living through it there, it's, you know, not just watching the shows, but also attending to the events. I attended events, you know, across the country just due to contacts, thank goodness, to them, to some of the talent, or not talent, but some of the folks that worked in the WWF merchandise department at the time. And I'll never forget that, because that was a huge influence in my childhood. But you know, just kind of going back there, is that I really have seen a change in the way, you know, kind of fans behave. And really, I guess you could say, like, you know, you have folks like, you know, Cornette that want to blame Vince Russo as the fawn and as the devil of wrestling. But in reality, that was what Russo did, with kind of incorporating kind of more of the smarks. That was going to, it was going to happen regardless with the internet. It was impossible. The internet has had so much of an impact on wrestling. Now everybody's a critic. Everybody's encouraged to do social media and be their own content producer. So I think that overall, as a fan base, that fans are just a lot more opinionated now. And now they have much more of a platform now, which encourages them with the internet, that they didn't have before, you know, prior to the internet days. All you could do is have conversations with folks. And I think that they're feeding off of the, you know, what some would interpret definitely as negativity that they're seeing with other people. And that's largely putting ideas in their head. So we're becoming a lot more opinionated in this day and age with what we like and what we don't like.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Like earlier today, I brought up, I blame everything on dirt sheets, social media. I really hate Dave Meltzer. You know what I mean? I missed the whole factor of like the surprise.
And just to add, just because you brought his name up, Dave Meltzer, I do think, and whereas I was a subscriber to the Wrestling Observer newsletter, you know, that was, you know, going back in its print form days, largely when it was circulated. And I met a guy in college, my undergraduate degree, kind of like in the tail end or the mid-90s, who was really responsible for kind of smarting me up, and he introduced me to the Wrestling Observer newsletter. So I started reading the Meltzer. And whereas, obviously, you know, when you're exposed to something like that for the first time, you're intrigued. You know, now you're starting to see the business side of things. But one of the things that Meltzer had really, that I knew had he had emphasized back then, was the bars with that he would apply, you know, to each and every one of the matches. That would be, whether it be on Raw, Nitro, you know, one of the pay-per-views. And I really think that fans that grew up after maybe 2000 or so, when the business was changing, and it's like they have no idea, I hate to say, what they missed back in the 80s and the 90s. And certainly they can look at me and say, oh, okay, well, people like me, we're just living in the past and everything. Well, I lived through both eras, you know, and yeah. I've experienced both eras. And my opinion is that, and it's only my opinion, but my opinion is strongly that the wrestling that we saw back then in those days was far superior, I feel, to what we see today. And you can put on all the glitz and the glamour you want in your production values, but that's just window dressing, in my opinion. You know, it's all sizzle and no steak, you know, in the end result. But yeah, to be fair, we do have a lot of very overly critical fans, but I do attribute Mel and his line of thinking in terms of treating wrestling more as a sport through those consistent match ratings. And that's what a lot of the younger fans grew up with. And that's kind of shifted it from real entertainment, which I thought that most of us had, you know, the way we looked at wrestling when we were younger during those days, to kind of viewing wrestling as a sport. I see a lot more people that look at wrestling from a technical aspect today. And granted, that's kind of like the Ring of Honor niche style that it had. And I just think that if people want to watch a actual sport where they want to see, you know, people competing, that they're going to tune to MMA or UFC. So why try to be something that you're not? You know, wrestling has always, you know, and not ashamed of it, you know, it's been lowbrow entertainment. And that's some of the things, like the characters and everything that goes into it. The characters and the storylines, I always felt, were really what drew. But again, people are a lot more vocal now. And when you consider their upbringings to what they were raised on, and heavily influenced, I think, by Meltzer, and now Meltzer, of course, is obviously seems to be shifting his line of thinking due to, you know, regardless of whether whatever influences that might be, kind of more to the AEW side, which I do feel is more in line with the old WWF style that we grew up on. But I do feel that his line of thinking had a very negative influence on, you know, people look to him and say, oh, Meltzer is the god, Meltzer, you know, so it's his views, and people began parroting those views, and I think that he had a lot to do with how wrestling got to where we are today.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that, because I grew up with the Dave Crockett era and the Bill Watts and all that, back when it was wrestling, when it was a sport, when you could watch great wrestling from down south.
It's still sport.
Not what I'm getting at. People are getting more towards the death stuff now, and they want to get hit with light bulbs and put through glass plates, and where's the technicality that we saw back then between Mr. Perfect and Scott Hall and you guys that knew what wrestling was, like Jeff Jarrett back then?
I feel like you're bringing this next question into this whole leeway, how we got there.
There we go.
So
segue
in. Go ahead, ask the question.
So do you feel that in the world of, in the business of professional wrestling lately, there's no more
storylines?
Why are we doing this ladder match? Why are we doing this thumbtack barbed wire? How did we get there? Like, it goes back to Scott Hall and Bret Hart WrestleMania 10, the leeway, the lead up to it, and all that.
You said Bret Hart.
Shawn Michaels. The same thing with Bret and Owen, and then because there were 6 months in between there, when Owen turned on Bret at Survivor Series, then you went to WrestleMania. Was WrestleMania 10? Was that one?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So there was storyline. Yeah, there was
build-up. That was WrestleMania 10. I remember that was the dual championship match with Lex Luger, Yokozuna, and then later on, Bret Hart facing Yokozuna and capturing the title.
Perfect, and Piper came in. It was great. But the question is, I feel that there's no storyline, no leadway into it now. It's just used to, we're going to go do that. Go ahead.
I absolutely agree with you with the lack of storyline. I have my, you know, again, all of us can only have our own opinions. So I'm not saying I'm some type of prophet or anything like that. We can only draw our own conclusions as to why things are happening. But I completely agree with you. It's like the storyline aspect seems to be falling by the wayside. But yeah, please continue though with your question. I'm happy to, you know, kind of share my thoughts on it.
Like last night, with the one CW stuff that we were going to do in Houston, Delaware last night, we had a good 3 months leeway into that cage match that was supposed to happen last night.
Mm-hmm.
There was a good leeway into it. There was a build-up. There was a storyline for it. That's one of the things that I actually like about that company, is that there's storylines and there's leadways and stuff like that, which is, should happen now, and you hardly see that. But that was the question, and you answered it, so thank you.
That is so much fun.
I think that is largely kind of gone by the wayside. And ironically enough, you know, just looking back in retrospect, you know, with growing up as a wrestling fan, it was, if you really think about it, the wrestling itself was maybe, you know, the match itself was maybe one of the least important things of a overall quality wrestling product itself. It's just that the standards had changed over years. And again, go back to Meltzer and his influences on kind of treating wrestling like, yeah, this is a true sport from a technical aspect. And I really feel that fans at the end of the day, and keep in mind, again, I grew up as a WWF fan, so I'm speaking from watching that product and being a fan of that product. But, you know, then again, it was the largest organization still at the time, you know, in the United States, is that fans at the end of the day just wanted to be entertained. So lots of times the wrestling itself, it was everything else but the wrestling. It was the character. It was the character development. It was the quality of the programs, the feud. It was the lead up to the match itself that made you want to see two guys get in the ring, hash it out. I think that one of the best examples I could think, SummerSlam 93. Oh, I love that feud between Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler. The heat that was in that
feud was absolutely
unbelievable. And then they masterfully do it, like up to the pay-per-view itself, SummerSlam. They don't even have Lawler. Lawler comes out in a crutch to try to, you know, say he got a fiery car accident to get out of the match. Here, this was a match, and it looked like it was a bait and switch. They had Doink come out to wrestle Bret Hart. But then Dex Tunney said, no, you know, after Lawler got himself involved in the match, hit Bret with a crutch, kind of exposed that, yeah, it was a facade. And then they had them two fight anyway. You know, Lawler and Hart, you know, with threatening Lawler for extension. That was absolute masterful storytelling. Lawler making fun of Bret's parents. The lead up to that match was just absolutely intense. The heat was off the charts. I think that's largely what is missing from today. in wrestling is the characters and the storytelling. And you can't expect the audience to say, okay, Joe Smith is going to come out, let's say, in black tights and wrestle John Jones and do that match every single week. You know, and expect the audience. That's why the audience sits there like a bump on a log. Lots of times the audience sits in absolute silence. You know? I'd love to survey the WWE fans one time. I think, why do you keep coming to this and watching and supporting the company, and you sit there at a show in dead silence?
Yeah.
See, for me, it goes back to 1980, 81. I know it was like three. But I remember watching on closed circuit television Andre the Giant tear that chain off of Hulk Hogan's neck, and everybody like freaked. Like, here's two friends, Andre turning on his best friend, and what happened to that? And stuff like that that should come back. Like, storylines.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
Speaking of Andre the Giant, Andre and Jake Roberts. I just saw a post on social media about that. The other day, because I believe that was WrestleMania 5, where Big John Studd was the referee. But Andre was afraid of snakes. And yeah. You just don't see this stuff anymore. It's like everything is so overproduced. And like I said, they don't put the effort into the storyline and characters any longer. And it's a shame, you know? And like I said, I have my opinions on that. And working in consulting for about 10 years, you know, there's a couple different types of contracts. One is, you know, you pay by, you pretty much the hour, you bill by the hour. The other is fixed price contracts where pretty much you're paid a flat fee regardless, and you have minimal obligations that you've got to meet in writing to your client. And I worked on a fixed price contract, and largely I would see within the consulting world, it was like, yeah, with this, you do the minimal amount of work for the contractual agreement, because that way then you can work on building and getting other contracts. And I think that began to open my eyes. That, in my opinion, again, is what I feel that WWE is doing, is that they are doing the minimal amount of work because they have that quote-unquote fixed-price contract with the television networks. So they're largely working, just as in the consulting world, they're doing, you know, you see it, the effort is simply not there any longer. So, you know, obviously the networks aren't as happy with the ratings, with what they were promised. They're not getting that, but that's what WWE is doing, is they're taking advantage of these fixed-price contracts.
Yeah, okay, let's...
Oh, yeah, I agree.
I want to go into your career right now. What got you into getting into the business, and who trained you and all that fun stuff?
How did we get there?
Well, I guess my first thing is, so I was, ever since, you know, I began watching in 1997. Granted, we were approaching the tail end of the Hulk Hogan, you know, years in his prime. Again, like I said, those were my largest influences. But ever since that time, I had always dreamed about, I had no interest in wrestling. I'm not an athlete by any means. I don't pretend to be. But I had always loved the manager. I'd always flock to the heels, basically, and just, you know, and I truly grew up in the golden years of managers with, you know, a gentleman who I didn't realize at the time there to his importance, but Bobby Heenan, again, became still to this day universally regarded as the greatest manager in wrestling history. Jimmy Hart, I love Jimmy Hart with his colorful jacket, Slick, just with his dancing. And
he's
and
still working, too.
Oh, I know, I saw him, and I think he did something with Andy as well, too. Show.
And he's also been up in the New York area doing stuff for ISPW.
Yeah, so that's great. Yeah, Slick, unfortunately, still one of the great four between him, Jimmy Hart, Bobby Heenan, and Mr. Fuji that are left alive. And Jimmy Hart there, too. I still have not yet met Jimmy Hart yet to say, but I loved him as well, too. Like I said, with all the tailored, colorful jackets and the megaphone at ringside. And of course, obviously, throw Sensational Sherry in there as well, too, just as one of the greats. But
The guy that came out with Dino Bravo, what was his name?
He had Frenchie Martin.
Yeah. Yes, Frenchie Martin.
Yeah, and then eventually Frenchie, I guess, had left or his contract ran out. I know he still performed as enhancement talent. I saw him at some of the house shows back then. But yeah, it was largely the managers that got me in. I love the good versus evil. I love the antics at ringside, seeing the manager Hunter secretly, you know, get their comeuppance, you know, at the end. But I always thought that, you know, they had such an influence on the actual product. And again, you go back to fans today and they say, oh, well, so-and-so, they don't need a manager. They can talk just fine. And any fan like that, I say, you can tell that those are younger fans because they didn't grow up in the era of managers where not everyone that had a manager necessarily needed a manager. But like Rick Rude never needed Bobby Heenan, but it's the package together that made it work splendid. Heenan and, you know, Ric Flair, Heenan was really largely retired, but they still paired them together. Honky Tonk Man and Jimmy Hart, you know, they didn't necessarily need each other.
Perfect.
But, the package together made it work and made it magical. So it's not just the talking aspect, but it's what goes on at ringside and correct. The antics of the right. manager at ringside and the match finish, the match outcome. Sometimes a manager's interference can lead to victory for their guy. Sometimes it backfires and costs their guy the victory. You know, mm-hmm. So it gives variety to the match itself. So for me, just kind of going back with your question, I had always kind of really wanted to be a manager. So it had taken me probably it was 2006. That's when I noticed on social media, and then of course, you know, that's talk about one of the you know, so the advent of social media, where local organization EWA was looking for a ring announcer. And I always, funny thing is, I would always try to emulate some of the best ring announcers and enjoy doing that. And in my Howard Finkel voice, you know, back then. But then I, you know, eventually altered it and everything to my own voice there too. So I eventually became a ring announcer, auditioned and became a ring announcer with Eastern Wrestling Alliance in Maryland with Jim Christian's group, and still work with them to this day. But I wound up getting a position in the West Coast, so that had only lasted for about a year. But then the timing of it had just worked out that, like I said, I was starting to just to get out of wrestling because I was becoming very bored with WWE's product at the time, and it was becoming a chore. So between the combination of moving to the West Coast and that had just largely gotten me out of wrestling. And like I said, I took a hiatus, a very, very long hiatus, almost about 13 years or so. And eventually, like I said, it was really AEW that brought me back, and I had such high hopes for the organization, and I think they're doing so many things right in this day and age. They're kind of, you know, again, they brought a lot of disenfranchised fans back, which is awesome. And about that same time, I had a call somebody had messaged me from EWA and say, hey, I know it's been a long time, but would you have any interest in ring announcing this show again? And I said, sure, you know, because it's just the timing once again had worked out. And then at that point, I had met Rico Hendrick, who was with EWA as a student, and you know, and he was working on doing a show on his own and promoting it himself, you know, using like the EWA facilities and ring as a student, which, you know, Jim allowed him to do. And I kind of put a bug in his ear, thinking, I said, you know, hey, you know, I'm happy to ring it out there for you. I wouldn't mind nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you know, being a manager, though, as well. So, and of course, what's going on in the back of my mind, I'm thinking to myself, well, even though even though it's been a long time, and obviously I'm certainly not getting any younger. So it really is either now or never, you know, as far as doing this in the indies and having a good time and enjoying yourself. And to his credit, and obviously very grateful for the opportunity, he said sure. And he said sure, you can manage me. And so that's kind of really where it went off from there. I really owe him everything. You know, since then, we've worked, like I said, SWO. We've worked, of course, 1CW, you know, and I do EWA to this day, you know, as well, too. So it really is thanks to Rico. Now, your question as far as the training goes, no. I mean, I've not really had any formal training, per se, as a manager. I did actually, I took a couple classes at some of the, like, I went up, like, the office school, for example, and and oh my God. And
that's a great one.
Here I was thinking for a tryout, I never knew that the wrestlers were expected to be in the same conditions as managers. I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to get through this. I tell you, driving up from Harper County, Maryland to Hazleton, and then driving back, that had never been my, the pain that was in my leg. My legs were like rubber getting back from how many squats that I did that day. And I was like, oh, I don't know how, it opened my eyes and saying, I don't know if I'm ever going to be in this physical condition. You know, I just want to go out there and shoot my mouth off and take bumps and, you know, and things like that. So that's kind of, so to answer your question, no, I honestly, and it's funny. I know he didn't himself when he started back that he didn't, and not that I'm comparing myself to him by any means. I mean, but he himself actually didn't have any formal training, but no, yeah. As far as, yeah, can I do basic back bumps and things? Sure. You know, they're relatively simple to do. And, but no, it's if I'm expected to do a move, you know, or so, then we just talk about it prior to the show, you know, and kind of work as we go. So I'm grateful that the companies that I work with have given, you know, certainly the opportunity to work with me. I guess, you know, join my work and everything, that they've taken that chance with me.
That's amazing. Like, you, like when I went to 1CW, you were the person that I was like, wow, this dude's awesome as a manager. Wow.
Yeah. And again, it kind of goes back to, I mean, I guess, the training, I guess, if you want to say, is just all those years of religiously watching television, of studying the greatest managers, you know, of all time work and what they do at ringside. That, you know, per se, I guess you could say in terms of training, that was my training, you know. So you can kind of see it, like I said. So I that's what I miss from wrestling today. I don't feel that managers are, you know, thank goodness, again, AEW has brought managers back. I think that's a huge step in the right direction. Vince has kind of been very obviously sour towards managers, and I think his philosophy is, Vince, I feel, has gone in the direction of his passion, I feel, for wrestling is completely gone. And I think that you see that through, like, the different areas that he's tried to get himself involved in, you know, whether it be the XFL, whether it be politics, whether it be movies and things like that. He wants to create more of a global enterprise, but his passion, I feel, for wrestling is gone. Hence, that's why, again, we go back to doing the minimal amount of work for, you know, the return being what, you know, the financial stuff. I think his sole passion nowadays is just literally making as much money as possible. And that's how billionaires, I guess, get off. You get off measuring my wealth stick is bigger than your wealth stick. And that's what becomes their drive in life. And, and you know, again, he's applied that philosophy towards all the cost cutting that he's done, you know, over the years, all the talent that he's released now just recently, despite record profit, putting, again, the least amount of work in from the creative aspect, you know, I think it shows that is his philosophy now. So, again, really thankful seeing that some managers, you know, are being brought back. Do I still think they could be used to greater potential? Absolutely, you know, than what's currently going on in AEW. But I really, you know, try to pay tribute with what I do, how I dress and everything to the great managers that I grew up with.
I agree with you. I totally agree. I love managers. I love everything in wrestling. I study everything. I study from the referee.
Who was the first manager you ever saw, Derek?
Well, I mean, it was, I would say probably it was, when you say saw, I guess meaning maybe on TV. Versus in TV, it was actually Jimmy Hart. It was the segment going back to 1990 with Earthquake, who appeared on the Brother Love show, and did the Earthquake splash the Hulk Hogan 3 times, quote unquote, mm-hmm. putting him out of wrestling. I just love hearing Jimmy Hart in his squeaky voice, you know, just veer him up, you know, and encourage him like the little insignificant, you know, cheerleader in the background there to encourage him. Okay, again, do it again, baby, right. You know, and through his megaphone. And so Jimmy Hart was really the first one. And I thought his wardrobe was awesome, you know, that he would get jackets and tailor his jackets towards each, get them airbrushed towards each one of his individual talents. So it was then that, and then I began seeing Heenan, you know. Now, obviously, if I would have started watching a little bit earlier, it probably would have been Heenan, you know, at the time, because, you know, Heenan obviously right. had largely fused with Hogan, but I think because that happened for a couple of years, they were giving Jimmy Hart a chance in the top, you know, spot with Hogan, working a main program with Hogan, and so it was just timing as far as how it worked out. out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say, yeah, and of course, Jimmy Hart was on the first house show that my dad took me to in Baltimore, Maryland, at the Baltimore Arena at the time. Headline, Earthquake and Jim Duggan.
Wow.
So yeah.
That's pretty cool. DB, who's first manager you ever saw?
My boss.
No. In wrestling, I mean.
It was Heenan and Jimmy Hart.
See, I've been watching for a long time, and the first one I saw...
Captain Lou. I forgot about him.
Sir Oliver Humperdinck.
Oh, my goodness. That kind of goes back into another topic, like a baby-faced male manager, right. too. Sure. Now, obviously, he was largely heel at the time in WWF, yeah. though. They, you know, he's used as a face, though, like with Bam Bam, I remember.
Right. He managed Bam Bam back in the early
80s. Yes. Yeah. Don't forget Gary Hart. Gary Hart's
Oh, my God, Gary Hart.
Gary Hart is an all-big
Well, if you're going that route to USWA, then you got to bring in General Skandar Akbar.
What about Colonel Parker?
Yeah, that was WCW.
So, like, we always forget about the women managers out there, like Sherry and...
Elizabeth, Baby Doll. Luna. Yeah, but it goes back to Baby Doll, who was out there with Steve Austin when Austin was down there in Smoky Mountain in USWA and Global, back when he had the long blonde hair.
Yeah, don't forget and Sunshine
and Precious with...
right.
Yeah.
And the girl that was with the Freebirds. Yeah, Precious.
Yeah.
Jimmy's wife.
So, I want to ask you a question. What was the best of you have been given by anybody, like managers or wrestlers, whoever out there?
Don't be 12.
You love saying don't be 12.
So, you know, the advice wasn't necessarily, it wasn't given to me as a person, but I do remember the famous quote in Ian's book about, you know, kind of, you know, you want to wrestle like a manager and manage like a wrestler. And so when I'm out, you know, at ringside, you know, I try to, I try to incorporate that manage like a wrestler, you know, on the outside, whether it be just through interference, just through sneakiness, trying to get involved, you know, try to really engage the crowd. Just like, you know, you're in the ring as a worker and, you know, you're doing your best to get crowd involvement. You know, the manager is obviously there to largely support the talent during slow portions, you know, perhaps of a match, maybe a rough hold is taking place. So the manager's there to kind of gear up the crowd and certainly engage the audience, which I absolutely love doing. But, I think that his overall Heenan philosophy of that is something that's largely incorporated, whenever I manage. And it's, you know, again, it's just so many years of just watching, you know, decades of just watching, you know, your greatest managers in action, just taking the actions of that they did to get it to really kind of draw attention, you know. And I think the art to it is really supporting, you know, your talent. But, you know, a lot of managers, I think more recent managers are like almost at function like a mini me. Like if we're going to have a manager, and of course in WWE, you can't call managers anymore. Vince doesn't like that word, but like the people that
I think
would
the word
have,
now is advocate.
Yeah, advocate, exactly, with Heyman. And don't get me wrong, I love Paul Heyman. He is right up there with the greatest managers, I feel like, of all time. But I think it's sad.
And one of the greatest minds.
Oh, absolutely. Without a shadow of a doubt. I also attended, you know, some ECW shows back then. So, you know, a lot of history, really, that I lived through. But, you know, a lot of today's people that will, quote unquote, stand at ringside, you know, for the, you can't call managers, it's like they function as mini-me. And I guess it's again, I try to practice, though, managers are really their own person, you know, they're a character just like anybody else, you know. Did Heenan, did he change himself, you know, for each of the talents that he managed, you know? Is Jimmy Hart, okay, well, Jimmy Hart, you know, he supports his talents through his various promotional, through his suits, you know. He'd wear his Earthquake jacket when Earthquake came out, the Mountie, you know, he'd wear his red tuxedo and stuff, which I thought was awesome, but he was still Jimmy Hart at the end of the day. And that's what I still try to function as, is that I'm my own person, you know. I'm there to enhance the show, as opposed to kind of being like a mini-me for any given talent.
I give a lot of credit to Jimmy Hart, because if he's booked on the show
awesome.
Now,
yeah.
he's putting up the chairs. He's doing everything.
I've seen it. That little guy has got so much energy. And a lot of people didn't realize that he started his career, of course, singing as a backup with the Gentry, you know. So his his career really started in rock and roll, and hence that's why he had the kind of the rock and roll, he'd wear a lot of his suits with music notes and did a lot of the writing, obviously, for a lot of the talent for their entrance music back then as well, too, along with Jim Johnston.
My gosh, he was amazing, too, because, like, he was on that Andy Kaufman feud. One of the best wrestling feuds I ever seen, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know Andy Kaufman wasn't a wrestler, but God damn, he got people pissed off, and I love that. That's one of the reasons why I always toured to the heels, because I love the part of I want to be the a-hole that I can to piss off everybody out there, and I miss that. You know what I mean? I miss wrestlers doing that stuff, trying to get people to go stab them in real life. You know what I mean? Really don't want that to happen, but
yeah. And I guess my approach to wrestling is that we're all going to have kind of like our different philosophies, and it's okay to have different. But I guess I had really viewed wrestling as no different than what you see on television and what you see in the movies, and that if it's done in television and it's done in the movie, wrestling is really no different. So sometimes you might do some controversial things in television and movies, but people realize at the end of the day that you're watching a show. So I do think that kind of the shifting towards political correctness and so forth. We talk about kind of fans sitting like bumps of logs in a lot of shows these days, but in large case, a lot of fans have done it to themselves, with kind of shifting, in certain directions like that, because it's really taken, potential elements out of, some potential really good hot storylines that you could do.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Another thing I want to bring up this next question in a way, because I'm against like the whole pet peeve thing, and I have pet peeves for everything. It's like I'm watching a referee and he's wearing red shoes and I hate it.
I agree too. There's with the referees. There too, referees. I do feel, and I know this has come under criticism on the internet, just in social media, with a lot of like the referees in AEW drawing way too much attention, to themselves and opening their mouth like at every other move, that a talent does, just like in disbelief to try to add to it. But yeah, I do agree that referees should kind of be adhering to it. I agree completely with you. There's certain professionalism you see on the indies, referees that come in their shirt untucked and things like that. And I'm like, how do you expect anybody to treat your organization seriously without standards like that,
Oh, yeah, people being in the wrong spot.
Wearing jeans or something, it's just, I'm totally with you.
Yeah, that's my pet peeve of the world, I'm, there's a lot of things that Dave hates.
Being in the wrong spot when you're counting your shoulders down.
There's a referee, I'm not a big fan of him, so I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to put him out there, but I watched him count at somebody's feet, and I'm like, dude, you're counting.
He's looking at the feet.
He's looking at the sheet, and he's doing the count, and I'm like,
wow,
that's not where his shoulder is. And he looked at me, and he got pissed off and cussed me out, and Kaner's like, yep, he's done.
I
make sure he's never on any shows I'm on. Yeah. And we did a show last Saturday, and we did a meet and greet, and the fan asked, who's the worst ref you ever worked with? And this guy was on the top of his list.
All the wrestlers said they weren't a fan of his.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. I know your boss, Sean Carlson, was looking for a referee, called him up, and he did a no-show. So,
ouch.
Yeah, I think he's not coming to 1CW anytime soon.
Trust me, if I'm ever repping on a show, I ask who the other refs are.
Yeah.
And I have my pick of refs who I love to work with. I can name five right off the top of my head.
Please don't.
No,
I don't want to get you over. Yeah,
but one of them has one of the most hilarious laughs I've ever heard, and he's just great to work with.
Oh gosh, you're talking about him. I love him too.
At the end of the day, I'm opinionated, but I truly am a humble guy. At the end of the day, aside from the opinions, just being strongly opinionated about everything, doesn't all have to be about me here.
Right, and I mean when we did the last 1CW show,
so
yeah, and I gotta say too, just with all the guys, just that I've met there too. It's just, the SWO crowd, a staff that works there, just the guys, the workers and everything, 1CW, absolute class act, and so happy, just being part of just a company, I'm very big, they say that one of the things with millennials, which I'm not, I'm a Gen Xer, but the big things with millennials is being genuine, is authenticity and being genuine, and that's what I say. Really, you have so much talent, so much staff. It's just you're working with genuine, nice people, and that really is just it's a blessing, just in many cases, to be working with you know, really class acts there too. So when big thanks to those.
When you get the chance to meet Matt Tremont students, I'll tell you, they are the nicest kids that ever came out of that school. They come up to you. You're not even part of the show.
No, they were taught well.
They're like, thank you for letting us be here. I'm like, I don't work here.
One of the things too is that, you know, I I'm old school in terms of the end product that I like, but I'm not a fan of the old school methods that a lot of teachers and a lot of the schools that they implied there. It just, you know, like, for example, I remember when Sherry had talked about being first trained, she said, her first teacher wanted to see if she was tough enough, and she got slapped right in the face. And she replied back, is that the best you got? And I'm like, absolute respect for her, but that should have never happened to begin with. And I think a lot of times there's the psychology and bullying, you know, that for lack of a better term, that happens in a lot of these places because it becomes a control thing.
Right.
And I would love to see us move forward and clean that old school mentality when it comes to training students and really up and start treating people like actual people. You know, you're a person, you're a student, you deserve respect, just like anybody else. And we have a professional working relationship together, just like more of an employer as opposed to some of these real old school, in some cases, maybe brainwashing tactics that they do to maintain control over students.
See, the way I was grown up, because I was brought into it because my brother is who he is, I was always taught that as soon as you walk in the building, shake hands, introduce yourself, say hi,
hugs to everybody.
Right. Lately, I hardly see that anymore. I don't even see them wiping feet when they get in the ring anymore, and I do it every single time.
Dude, you weren't watching me. I was wiping my feet getting in the ring.
Well, I know you were. I wasn't talking about you.
Oh, okay.
I see these guys, and pardon my language, I see some of these guys that don't think their shit don't stink.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm going to tell you, like, if I walk in the building and you don't say hi to me, I'm going to walk up to you every single time. Like, we had a girl, we did a show last Sunday for Super Crazy. We were hanging out, and one of the photographers never came up and said hi at all the whole entire time. Everybody else did, except for this one person, and we were ragging on her about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but moving on.
Okay, we have a question called Table 5. So you're the fifth person at the table, okay? You need to put four more people sitting at that table. Four. He's holding up four fingers. Yeah, four. There you go, four.
I can always hold up one finger.
And they have to be managers that you will love to sit at the table with you. You can make it dead or alive.
That's a pretty good one.
Have fun with that.
Have fun? Okay. Well, I probably would have to go with Bobby Heenan, being the first person at the table, and certainly Jimmy Hart as well too. Paul Heyman would be right up there as well. And as far as the fourth person, I probably would go with actually Gary Hart being up there as well too. I think that Gary Hart is probably one of the most underrated managers that's out there that doesn't deserve the credit that he maybe should get, but just in terms of his style, his interviews and so forth. So I think I would bring someone in like from that area. So Heenan, Heyman, Jimmy Hart, and Gary Hart.
Okay. Four H's.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, you did. Four H's. Wow.
That was not planned.
No, that wasn't planned. No. Wow. That's the first.
Cool, yeah.
That's the first. First with three H's. Holy. Four H's. Four. H's. I'm sorry, four.
So it's the 4-H club.
The 4-H club, yes.
That's right.
Oh, I like it.
Wow.
So we have an old question that...
Uh-oh.
It's called the Three Matches of Hell.
Okay.
I hated that cage. I swear I did.
So it has to be... You have to give us three matches that you managed that you loved, and then your all-time favorite, like, growing up of managers in the business and...
The matches that they did.
Yeah, the matches they did or evolved. Yeah.
Okay, so three matches that I loved that had managers in them. Is that right?
Yes, and the other one is you. as your manager of your favorite matches that you did.
Okay. So as far as three matches that I watched growing up that I loved, and man, I wish I could do that Lawler versus Bret Hart match at SummerSlam, but I can't because there was the manager really at ringside for that.
Yeah.
But I think that Lee versus Andre the Giant at WrestleMania 3 with Heenan at ringside. Heenan had, it was amazing just kind of watching that, the reaction that Heenan had. And of course, that's when they had the little carts come in the ringside being driven. I so miss those.
Yeah, the golf carts.
That was done at, exactly. And I can only imagine that they don't use them anymore because maybe they think that from a security standpoint that wrestlers are kind of trapped in them or talent's trapped if someone wants to throw something at them. But yeah, there was a lot of trash being thrown at Heenan and Andre the Giant on the way there. So the heat was kind of, you know, unreal.
And when they were in the ring, I remember that too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So that would definitely be one of them. Also, another interesting one was, and even though I think they really hated working with each other, and I know Heenan never liked them, but Ultimate Warrior versus Ravishing Rick Rude at SummerSlam 93, that was the cage match.
Yeah.
And if you remember, Heenan kind of slammed the door, you know, in Ultimate Warrior's face. And I thought it had production, it had the best close-up on Heenan's face with a smirk, just like a sly smirk after he did it. And then, of course, eventually he got his when he got pulled into the ring. But that was something that was really memorable for me as a kid. And let me see, as far as the third match goes, go ahead.
No, I love
that. No, we were just laughing about that.
Oh, we love that.
Oh, okay.
I love that. That was awesome.
It's like Chevy Chase and Caddyshack.
Gotcha. Okay, as far as the third match goes, one of the concepts that I really loved was the old school Survivor Series. And there was a, because from a manager aspect, lots of times you would get managers teaming up with other managers, depending on what the team was. So there was this, seeing Jimmy Hart and Slick come out with Dusty Rhodes team taking on the Big Boss Man team in Survivor Series 1989. I absolutely loved the interaction just between Jimmy Hart and Slick. There was another similar match where Jimmy Hart and Slick both worked together at SummerSlam 89, as a matter of fact. It was Rick Martel with the Rougeau brothers. So seeing managers kind of coordinate themselves and you know, patting each other on the back and having one get up on the ring while the other starts getting into the ring. You know, one get up on the ring to distract the referee while the other one gets up and kind of does their thing. I get the biggest joy out of it. Just seeing two of the, kind of instigators kind of working together. So, and really any match with, but I love that Survivor Series. As a matter of fact, it was also memorable too, because you had a loner in Bad News Brown, Bad News Allen, that was in the Big Boss Man team, I guess had to step in, I think for the winner. No, it wasn't the winner. It was, he had to step in the match. And of course, the funny thing is, and even they were talking this up on commentary, there's like, you know, Bad News is a loner. This kind of event is not his forte. And sure enough, Boss Man hit him by accident and Bad News wound up walking out, you know, leaving a man down on the team. That is so much of the stuff that I really miss. Dusty Rhodes taking on Boss Man in singles matches, seeing them, Dusty Rhodes, Sapphire, Slick, Akeem all dancing, you know, at Madison Square Garden, crowd getting on Slick's case and everything. But yeah, I tell you, fans, they absolutely love that gimmick with Dusty Rhodes and Sapphire together. I know the big thing about the, and I realize I'm kind of rambling a little bit here, so I apologize about that. But it goes back into my passion, like I said, that I love.
It's one of the reasons why I'm loving this so much. I have a smile. Like, dude, this is an awesome interview so far.
Oh, God, thank you. Thank you.
I thought you were just hungry.
So, as far as the all-time favorite match that I was involved with, I probably would have to go with, just an honor for me, just because it was, you know, kind of the main event really with 1CW. For 1CW, it would have to go with Bad Bang versus Models Millennium. I really enjoyed that match, just for the honor just of really being in the main event that day, just being at ringside for him. We did a little thing with the wine as well too, where I was pouring it in Miles's mouth, and I said, oh, it would be so cool if we did like an Indiana Jones thing, you know, just try to, you know, where Indiana was forced to drink the blood of Kali Ma and kind of, you know, put him under that spell, and I did that, and he spit it right back out in my face, and then he got the biggest chuckle. I go back and review the tape and see the audience members laughing, you know, and that put a smile on my face, seeing that it brought joy, you know, to the fan's face. So I think that's solely because it was part of the main event. I will say for FWO, by far my favorite match was it was a tag team match with Sonny Kiss and Ace Dallas taking on Rico Hendrick and Tim Rush, and it was literally deafening in the building that night in Seven Valleys. It's just the crowd absolutely loved Sonny, and crowd really loved Ace Dallas up there too. But definitely an honor just being in that match, being at ringside for that, interfering in the match, and the crowd just literally just booing the hell out of me. You know, just when I was doing just like kind of like my opening monologue to introduce Rico Ford. So I'm going to say those two, for two different reasons, were really my favorite matches that I've been involved in to date.
You got one more?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were just doing the favorite match. I didn't think we were doing three of my.
Yeah, yeah. Three of yours. Yes. Yeah,
so,
that's the game. That's the game.
Gotcha. Okay.
And you know how to play it?
What's that?
He said, that's the game. And I said, I bet you know how to play it.
Yes, I do.
I think my other favorite would probably be the casket match also that I was involved with Rico and Ace Dallas at FWO as well, too. Again, the FWO audience really up there is just, they're so into the matches. Having a casket match take place and just the heat in the building, we're trying to stuff Ace into the casket there too. I really, really just enjoyed that match. I think I was in a purple suit that night. And as far as my wardrobe goes, my goal is trying to really wear a different outfit for every event that I appear on. So I try to vary it up so the audience never sees me in the same suit twice. So now that's not necessarily across promotions, but like on a per promotion level, I have to cut it off somewhere. Yeah. Spending ridiculous amount of money just on that stuff. But I think that just changing up your appearance is so important, you know, and you would see the managers wear big suits and big fancier suits, you know, for the big matches on pay-per-view. So again, I try to incorporate that mindset into kind of my management style.
So there's a legend that I work with named King Kalua.
Okay.
I don't know if you ever had a King Kalua or not, but King Kalua, he always walks in dressed to the nines, full suit and everything else, and the suit he wears that day into the building, his ring gear will match.
Really?
Yeah, you didn't notice that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, so when he walked in last Sunday wearing the white suit, he had on a white outfit in the ring. When we had him on the one Super Crazy show, he had on a purple outfit and he had on purple gear.
Did not notice that. I will notice that next time.
Right, and he changes his outfit every single time. And gotta mind you, he is 63 years old and he's still going in this business. So very few. I can only name two off the top of my head that are still going like that.
He looks like an 80s wrestler.
Right. And so does Mr. Ooh La La, but still.
Yeah. So we got two more questions because I'm gonna do the last one. Our five question doom is the last one we're doing. But I wanna ask you about a geek out moment.
Ooh.
Okay. Geek out. It's okay to geek out, and like if you see something in the back,
we both did it at Icons. I'm not gonna deny it.
I do it all the time because like you've seen people you looked up to.
You saw the Powers of Pain walk by. You geeked out. It was really cool to have a conversation with Samu. That was geeking out.
It was fun. Like David Arquette. I geeked out for him when I met him.
Well, David Arquette is responsible
for the day pictures.
For the Daves.
Derek, when we see you again, we had to do a day picture.
Oh, okay. Absolutely. I'm down.
Okay.
So, real quick, before you ask the next question.
The geek out question. Do you want to tell him about the Dave question?
I want to tell him about the Jerry Briscoe Dave geek out.
You had to tell him why we do a day picture.
So, like, before you, I'll just mention something really with Briscoe. just kind of like a fun thing here too, is that, like, I was kind of alluding earlier that there was a buddy of mine that wound up getting just through meeting folks in the WWF merchandise department, the main guy who we first started talking to, and it really, he was a friend through the guy Greg, who I met in college, who had introduced us, but the merchandise, his name was Jimmy Miranda, and it was so interesting just seeing, unfortunately, he passed away. God, I want to say it was around 2002, maybe around that period. Wow. But he would hook. They actually did a tribute to him on Raw, like one of the very few non-talent, you know, personnel that worked for the company. Jim Ross actually did something. They showed Jimmy's picture just on a Titantron, just how much he meant to the company. But yeah, unfortunately, he passed away. But he was such a pleasure to meet that guy. And he and his assistant, Derek, who now works, unfortunately, he was let go during the layoff there too, but was recently rehired back there too. They would hook us up with seats. Now, obviously, we had to provide our own transportation, me and a buddy of mine, but yeah, we would travel when we had more time on our hands, you know, and more disposable income around the country. I went to WrestleMania up in, one of the best WrestleMania, I think, of all time, folks regard as WrestleMania 17 in Houston, Texas. I was there for that. WrestleMania 18 up in Toronto, Canada. I was for the legendary Hulk Hogan versus Rock match. I was there for that, and there was absolutely nothing like it. But yeah, we used to see like a lot of the talent just at the, like, the hotels and everything. We saw Jerry Briscoe at a hotel, and a buddy of mine couldn't resist. He just said, walk by. He goes, "Yes, sir, Mr. McMahon." And of course, all that had finished at the day. And Briscoe, just, he was a good sport, and he said it right back to me. "Yes, sir, Mr. McMahon." So Briscoe, just a good guy, a good sport. Sad to see him laid off. I know he's staying active, though, with his podcast now. But I just had to get that little thing in with Briscoe before you mentioned what you were going to go into.
So we were hanging out one night at House of Hardcore right here in Philadelphia, and David Arquette was on the show. And we're sitting there hanging out, and now there was probably about five Daves with us.
So my whole thing is, in life, I wanted to make people go be friends with every Dave I can be. Is that Dave Meltzer? These are the Daves I know. And so my whole thing is, like, at work, I met these guys, like all these Daves. So it was like, I should like hang out with all these Daves at work. So when somebody goes, "Hey, Dave," we all go, "Yes." It's the comedy in my head. You know what I mean? I'm laughing about it all the time. So I thought about, oh, dude, let's get a five Dave picture. And boom, right there. And then we got the five Daves pictures and five people named Dave.
David Arquette made us make the D with our hands and everything else.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
I didn't do it.
Yep. No, David Arquette did.
Oh, David Arquette did? Yeah. And then, like, later on, I started going, Dave, let's go take pictures with people named Dave. That'll be great. And then I'm like, it's kind of hard to find people named Dave. Ah, this is a great idea. Let's get name tags saying my name is Dave and put it on their shirt. And that's where the Dave pictures come
got
in.
It.
It's a little smaller.
I remember Dave. I was just going to say Dave Sullivan gimmick. Dave Sullivan thing backwards. That was the first thing that popped in my mind.
So we're hanging out at Icons back in December, and I'm talking to Jerry Briscoe, and Jerry Briscoe notices our shirts. My buddy Jason, who's one of the ring announcers I work with, I'm like, "Can you hook it up?" He's like, "Go ahead." I'm like, "Okay, cool." So we go to stand over next to Jerry, and Jerry goes, "Wait a minute, wait a minute." He starts grabbing a piece of paper and writing the name Dave on it. I'm like, no, we have this covered. And I handed him one of the name tags. And he goes, "Oh, God, you guys thought of everything." He puts it on, and Jerry Briscoe goes, "This is over. This is great." And I'm like, wow, coming from a legend like Jerry Briscoe thinking our stuff is over?
Yeah.
Kind of geeked out with that. That was pretty freaking cool. Thank you.
Isn't it such a pleasure, though, when you meet talent, like folks that you respect, and they really wind up turning into down-to-earth guys that are, like, super cool to be with? I don't think there's, like, a greater feeling related to wrestling, just meeting somebody who you respect, hold in very high regard, and they're very genuine people, and, you know, just like anybody else.
But at the same time, sometimes there's people that go the other way, but...
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I know a couple. You know,
so do I, but...
I don't want to talk to him. I put a list in my head that I don't want to do interviews with.
Nope. I can think of plenty, but we're not going there.
Yeah. We could tell you after the show, but right now.
Oh, yeah.
But we don't want to put it out there. But
all right. To quote the great band Europe.
What is your career, your favorite geek out moment?
Mine?
No, not yours. Derek. Nobody wants to know about you.
I think the first talent who I wound up meeting was actually just, and this was at the time when, like I said, I was getting smartened up by my friend Greg, who I went to college with. And of course, I noticed we had a golf class together, and he had a WrestleMania 10 jacket on. So naturally, we just started talking a conversation. And I was like, oh, wow. It's like, he really knows like the insides of like, because he had met talent and all at the time. But we went out to Sabatino's, which those you know might know is a very popular hangout just in Little Italy in the Baltimore area. Whenever you know guys come to town, and we had dinner with Bill Dunn, who was that's a name from the past, ring announcer at the time in WWF, and I think that's when they were working on trying to get. You may remember him. Do you guys remember Bill Dunn?
I do.
Yeah, I think I do.
You do? Okay. Yeah, exactly. He was at WrestleMania 10, just like the opening match and the closing match, just subbing for Finkel, because Finkel did that thing with Harvey Whippleman, I guess, and all. But, and getting the hair and all that stuff. Yeah. They didn't have that match at Mania, but of course it eventually led to that. Let's try our best to forget that. But yeah, it was kind of a geek out moment just because I was at the time just because you know just being young and oh wow I'm actually meeting somebody who you know is on TV. I wouldn't say that you know just me and Bill itself wasn't like a huge geek out moment necessarily for me, but that was like kind of like the first geek out moment of meeting like somebody who worked for the company that you know I really at the time emulated. There was a house show in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where we took the guy who I mentioned, Jimmy Miranda, to, and it was a big snowstorm that night, and we had to drive him. So we picked him up from the airport at Philly, and we took him to Hershey, and then after the show, we had to drive to D.C. because that was for Raw that was in D.C. that night, and that was something else. But at the show at Hershey, obviously, you know, you go to a house show, a little bit more, obviously, a lot more laid back atmosphere.
Oh yeah.
We had a chance to meet, you know, I had always wanted to meet the Hardy Boys, at the time. So it was at that show I had met, both Matt and Jeff Hardy. And, you know, I still smile when I see people to this day talk about meeting, like, you know, and I want to say, like, even Matt Hardy in particular about how, like, absolutely pleasant, that and what a class act Matt was. And he truly was. I remember, he made conversation with my buddy for a couple minutes. Took a very, very genuine photograph with us. I was like, this is so super cool that he took the time to do that. And Jeff was pretty nice too. But I had always wanted to meet them just because I like their style, you know, just kind of growing up and seeing the attitude there. I was like, wow, I really like what these two do in the ring. And I thought they had a great future. You know who was also very pleasant was Deborah McMichael. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing her in Philadelphia, and she was extremely classy. A lot of the folks up there, you know, just at the time, just very down to earth, very humble people. Molly Holly, you know, for example, Molly Holly of all people, like she would. We were after a show. I want to say, I think it was after that show in D.C. actually that I was talking about. She actually, after the show was over, she joined the ring crew, and she had a hat on just to try to avoid being, you know, recognized or much. But she was helping out on the ring crew, you know. Which I thought, wow, that is super cool. But yeah, my geek out moment, I think, would probably be meeting the Hardys. I did meet Triple H as well too. The Rock. Oh my God, yeah. I was there with my buddy Greg. Now all we took was an elevator ride down together, but that was that was special at the time because Rock was certainly it was in his prime. So we had a couple words just on the way down. But I thought that was super cool. Oh, another elevator ride that was totally not planned was we were at a pay per view up in Buffalo, No Mercy, 2000. And elevator had opened on my, you know, I forget whatever floor I was on, but, you know, like down to the lobby. And who gets in the elevator? And it's just me in the elevator at the time, but Edge gets in the elevator.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
So we kind of struck up conversation there. And of course, I wished him the best and everything, and vice versa as well, too. But that was cool. So, yeah, no, number of geek out moments, I guess, for me. You know?
I think one for me and it was pretty cool, was actually sharing a beer with James Storm.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we were at the last Icon.
I shared a cigarette on that same topic. It jumped in my memory. I shared a cigarette with Gary Martel on the outside of BWI.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, James Storm, one of the most awesome guys.
Sorry about your damn luck.
Right, but I mean, we just talked. Nobody was coming up to his table. I'm like, dude, it's James Storm. Nobody wants to meet James Storm? Come on.
I did.
No, yeah. Like, really? It was really cool to meet James Storm.
Speaking of going up to his table, did you give Virgil the same treatment?
Virgil wasn't there.
If Virgil was there.
If he was there, it would have been a different story.
All right. I saw him up at Wild Wild New Jersey, and this was when he had just started kind of making his rounds and getting known for, you know, kind of how he is nowadays.
It was the Wildwood Convention Center.
Wildwood Convention Center. Me and a group of buddies went up and happened to see him there. And it wasn't like a wrestling-related convention.
What is it? The Monster Truck. He's usually right there with that Monster Truck thing, and he sits in there, and that's where he signs.
But Virgil.
I used to love doing the Wildwood shows. They were always fun.
See, me with the virtual thing, I had to have DiBiase right there, too, so I can get them both signed.
You mean the Reverend Ted DiBiase?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to call him. Okay.
I still feel he was the greatest heel of all time. DiBiase, the million-dollar man.
Correct.
So, moving on to our last question. The hell was that?
That sounds a little scary. We get ready to see a horror song?
Yes, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is now time for the five questions of doom.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm a big fan of horror movies. Again, surprise, surprise, it's the classic horror movie. So, no, it sounds like a pretty cool segment.
So, five questions of doom is non-wrestling questions. So, question number one. Oh, here we go.
Question number one.
McDonald's? Oh, my gosh. McDonald's or Burger King?
McDonald's or Burger King?
God, there's reasons why I like both of them, but I think I'd still have to, overall, the whole product, I'd have to go with McDonald's. But so McDonald's, the fries, the menu offerings, but Burger King, yeah, love Burger King burgers over McDonald's. But the flame broiled, but the overall package has got to go to McDonald's, in my opinion.
For me, honestly, I would go to McDonald's for breakfast and then go to Burger King.
Oh, I love their breakfast.
I think McDonald's
it's so rare that I have breakfast nowadays, but when I go there, it's like the hash browns, the hotcakes, I pig out. I hate it.
Yeah, no, you're fine. But I mean, I just think the McDonald's breakfast package is better than the Burger King.
I concur with that.
Vice versa for lunch.
Although I will plug Burger King's French toast stick, though.
Oh my God, yes, I agree. Completely agree with that.
Okay, yep. Okay. Ready for question number?
Hit the music.
Question
number
two. Monsters or Adam's Family?
Probably going to have, I'm going to have to go with the Adam's Family, I think, on that one.
I do like the Adam's Family.
They had this game. If you still look up on Genesis, so again, I'm really dating myself here, but my first gaming console was the Atari. But eventually, of course, the Genesis days came, and I had a game called Pugsley Scavenger Hunt on that. It's still regarded as one of the most difficult games. I never did finish it, unfortunately. But I was determined to beat that thing, and I'm usually still pretty good. You know, occasionally I still play some games, you know, to this day. But that game, if you look it up, it's hard as hell. You see so many people bitching and complaining about it because the difficulty of that game.
Ready for question number three?
Question number three.
Fred Flintstone or George Jetson?
Fred Flintstone or George Jetson?
Wow.
I'm going to have to, I loved the whole futuristic thing when I was a kid, I'm going to have to go with George Jetson. I love the whole Jetson mantra, just wondering what the future was going to be like, flying cars.
They did the movie, too.
I say that, but at the same time, Fred Flintstone, there's parts of him I kind of go back to, like, All in the Family, you know, with Archie Bunker kind of being Fred Flintstone. So that part, I think, is absolutely hysterical.
But do you remember the movie, Jetsons Meet the Flintstones?
Yeah.
I do remember the movie, but I never saw it.
I saw it.
So, thing.
Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. Shut up.
Question
number four.
Oh my gosh. Longest road trip.
Longest road trip.
Well, if I'm going to be technical about it, my longest road trip was cross country. when I moved out to California for that, when I moved out to California for a year and a half, and it took me, I guess it was about 3 days. I made pretty good timing out there, but I literally drove cross country from Maryland to LA, California, just to, and I moved out there for, like I said, for about a year and a half, and it kind of seeing just, it was a thrill. It was a thrill driving through just America, and seeing, West Virginia. I'd driven through at the time. West Virginia, I still think.
He's singing the song in the back of his head now.
Yeah, Country Roads.
West Virginia.
West Virginia, But that state is so unique just because it's like there's no flat land. It's like you're either going up, down, left, right, at any given time. It's like whether road.
It's like playing a video game.
I remember when GPS was first kind of introduced in the market around like 2005, 2006, and I had it for a job that was a travel position, and it was telling me like turn left here, and if I would have done that, I would have driven right off a mountain. So that's what the mountains kind of did to really GPS, I guess, at the time. But yeah, technically speaking, my longest road trip was going through. Okay, so you go through Kansas, you drive through, Wisconsin, and you kind of see what you see out there, just in terms of just bare flat land. But I tell you, man, when you start driving through Colorado, just absolutely beautiful. Utah, beautiful. Two totally different states, but just states of beauty in their own right. I remember Utah, it was maybe about like 1 o'clock in the afternoon out there at the time, and it's like the sky was like pink and purple, in the afternoon, and it was really cool to see with like all the mountains. So even though kind of seeing like desert like conditions just like out in Utah, so different from Colorado, it's just each state kind of has its own beauty in its own right there. To Colorado, there's springs, and Colorado Springs, driving through that, just absolute beauty.
Okay, let's do question number five. And
question number five.
Favorite James Bond movie?
Favorite James Bond movie.
Sounds good. I think for, again, dating myself, but I got to go back to Tomorrow Never Dies. I love the whole media aspect of it there too, just with and the whole plot, towards it with creating incidents, that happen and for purposes of coverage there too. I love the plot of that one, I think. So, yeah, I think I'm going to go with that one.
I'm a big Dr. No fan. I love that film.
Are you?
Yeah. Sean Connery's will always be my favorite James Bond. But I do like Daniel Craig. So he's number two.
See, why does nobody talk about Pierce Brosnan?
Because he's not
only... That one, Tomorrow Never Dies was Pierce Brosnan. Right. Maybe for that one, but that might not have been what, you were referencing. So.
No, like...
I think you were just commenting on Daniel Craig. Yeah.
GoldenEye was his best, I think.
And I mean, nobody talks about Roger.
Roger Moore.
Nobody talks about Roger Moore.
Because Roger Moore movies went to a weird way after, like, Moonraker. I think it's the worst Bond movie ever. But that's my opinion.
I mean, they took the K out of there and put a P. That's what that movie was.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And I like Timothy Dalton better than...
Timothy Dalton was good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite Pierce Brosnan movie wasn't a James Bond movie, so...
This is Doubtfire?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I knew it was.
Ladies and gentlemen, that has been the five questions of
This is the social media part. Do you have any social media for the fans?
Oh, media for what? I'm sorry. I missed that.
Do you have
your plugs?
For your plugs. Like social media plugs.
Okay, there you go. You can catch me on Facebook and Twitter. I don't want to say, I'm all around media on TikTok. Again, I'm old-fashioned there, too. But, certainly pretty active on Facebook and Twitter. You guys want to come check me out. Dazzling Derek Benish.
So one of the things that I like to say before we end the show, when you come on the 2300 Wrestling Podcast, you become part of our family.
So welcome to the family.
I really do mean it. Welcome to the family.
Well, thank you. And it's really been a pleasure to do it. I really appreciate you guys reaching out and asking me to do this. Like I said, you do have a lot of old school folks that are maybe frustrated with the direction that the wrestling industry has kind of gone in over the years, but still have that fire, still have that passion for the style that they grew up on, that just, in many cases, that style is new. to today's audience there too, that certainly didn't grow up in that time. So, you know, just having the opportunity to perform and the opportunity to kind of just kind of show that style to some of today's younger fans is definitely a pleasure, while certainly giving some nostalgia to some of the older fans that are still around.
Oh, yeah. So thank you. Thank you very much.
And no, I really thanks, do no, mean. Thank you.
I do mean everything. I'm going to hit the ending button and then we'll do the little promo. And then, I have a couple, like, I have a note for you at the end of everything, but I'm going to go off it. So,
okay.
I'm going to hit the button.
Not that button. Not the gumdrop.
Not this button?
Not the gumdrop button.
Not the gumdrop button.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. This has been the 2300 Wrestling Podcast. I'm Dave Keener alongside DB Richards, and we'll see you in the ring. And I would also like to thank Dazzling Derek Beneshi for coming on our show today.
Benish. Benish. Just say it.
Get
Benish.
It right. He did that.
Repeat after me.
Thank you again.
You spawns of Satan, you heathens, you deviants. The end times are near, but until then, you are listening to the 2300 Wrestling Podcast.
Sam Alfalzi here.
And Zach Ravix.
Super Crazy Wrestling, Super Crazy Arena, Skid Row Academy. We are indeed the best facility in New Jersey. There's no doubt about that. Yeah, probably in the world. Extremely top three, I would say. We have very terrific trainers. Actually, they all come from the Ring of Honor Dojo, so you already know you're...
So they're going to be great, and they're definitely great.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You're going to experience some, you know, pretty elite stuff. You know, we're all about intensity here, you know. We're always here to help. We're always reach one, teach one. That's our main thing. You know, I feel like if you're a person that really feels like wrestling is your dream and that's what you want to accomplish, this is the best goal to come to.
Or burn.
Okay.
What Brack said.
So, once again, you know, best school probably in the world. Definitely in Jersey. You can find it. You can find it on Facebook, Super Crazy Wrestling and Skid Row Academy. And Instagram, Super Crazy Wrestling, Skid Row Academy. You can contact Melissa Pena or O-Dog. And he'll come find you if you don't find him.
Or I will.
Or
Brax will.
Or Brax.
You'll
burn.
No, you won't burn.